human rights. But unfortunately, what we have seen in Afghanistan, we have seen exactly the opposite. When the United States claimed that they were there to bring democracy and freedom and everything related to it and the rule of law, quote unquote, the manifestation was unfortunately very different. We see the mistreatment of many suspects in Bagram, but also in Guantanamo Bay, and where a lot of suspects were unfortunately subjected to inhumane treatment by U.S. officials, and that obviously didn't really line up with international law at all. So this brings us to a next point, a very important one, whether the United States has actually was able to uphold those norms and regulations of international law. And I think, and with me, many Afghans are strongly convinced that they did not. In fact, they have violated many norms and rules of international law.
Well, can you tell us some examples of violations that you know that took place inside of Bagram?
Well, there is a very very well-known technique that was used by the United States, namely waterboarding, which is also often coined as enhanced interrogation techniques. But if you write that on a Word file, the same file would probably ask you whether you actually meant torture by that, because it actually means torture, and torture as such is prohibited under international law. And we have dozens of witnesses who believe or who have witnessed it themselves, obviously, from experience how the United States treated them or their relatives, and it was not in a very good fashion or according to international law. And most of these people were suspects. We don't know even as of yet whether they were real terrorists or whether they were really involved in terrorist activities. But because they had a discretion, the United States, to do whatever they deemed necessary, and they did it with impunity because this brings us to a next point. According to so-called status of forces agreement, which they signed together with the puppet regime in Afghanistan that the U.S. has installed, a U.S. soldier or official cannot be held accountable for any mistreatment of Afghan prisoners. So they did it with impunity, and waterboarding was a very obvious example, but we also have a story of other forms of inhumane treatment, other forms of torture, rape. So this a lot of things that happened in Bagram obviously runs counter against the very fabric of Afghan society. And it's very sad that those things actually happen, but that's what you get when human rights and when you see that in conjunction with counterterrorism measures taken by occupation forces.
Ms. Aryeh, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. But not all the 5,000-plus prisoners in Bagram are unidentified. The U.S. military did release the names of some 645. A few of these names even come with a face and a personal story, like the story of Delawar, an Afghan taxi driver who was kidnapped and severely tortured to death. Later, his prison mates kept this information from his mother and wife and five-year-old daughter to spare them the pain. There was even a public court case for the murder of Delawar and another prisoner called Habibullah. So you may wonder why there hasn't been a public outcry against such criminal acts committed by the U.S. military in Western countries. Well, the answer lies in a lesser-heard form of terrorism: character assassination. That's right, character assassination. Well, ever since Americans watched the Twin Towers collapse in horror and were officially introduced to the American War on Terror, they have been made more and more desensitized to such criminal acts. Hundreds of news items were conjured up about acts of terrorism by men who supposedly traveled halfway across the world to kill innocent people simply because they hate democracy. Men who are from the region named by certain powers, the Middle East. Men who are nearly always Muslim. Muslim men in countries like Afghanistan are demonized and called terrorists for merely daring to take up arms against those who attack their country. Now, the men who are willing to give up their lives defending their mothers and wives, and men who are themselves the biggest victims of terrorism. These men have had to deal with the repercussions of callous decisions made far away, decisions like the one unveiled by a former American general. Listen to what he reveals about the so-called war on terror.
So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
For many Americans and others who have rarely encountered terrorism, except on mainstream media, terrorists have dark hair, long beards, and are nearly always Middle Eastern or Arab and Muslim. But to the millions of people across the world who have been victims of bombings, kidnappings, and imprisonment without due legal process, terrorists are often white and clean-shaven, have started countless wars and run prisons and torture facilities like Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, and Bagram across the world. Well, thank you all so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. And until next time, I'm Marzia Hashim.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the resignations of Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid, both considered potential future UK leadership contenders, came at a critical moment for Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Elections to the 1922 committee executive in coming days are expected to strengthen the hand of rebels, hoping to call another vote of no confidence in Johnson's government. We now present you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Rowena Mason and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled Sajid Javid and Rishi Sunak Quit, Throwing Boris Johnson's Future into Doubt. Please stay with us for more. In Britain, Boris Johnson's premiership was on the brink of collapse after the Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid and a string of Conservative aides dramatically quit, dealing a crushing blow to his authority after a slew of self-inflicted scandals. Publishing damning resignation letters within minutes of each other, Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid pointed to a lack of grip in Downing Street. The Prime Minister attempted to recover his authority by swiftly appointing Nadhem Zahawi as his Chancellor and Steve Barclay as the Health Secretary. But the credibility of the move was undermined as reports emerged that Zahawi had threatened to quit unless he got the job instead of Foreign Secretary Liz Truss during a power struggle in No. 10. The resignations of Javid and Sunak, both considered potential future leadership contenders, came at a moment of significant danger for Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Elections up to the 1922 committee executive in the coming days are expected to strengthen the hands of rebels who hope to call another vote of no confidence. There is growing expectation among MPs that there will be moves to change the rules to allow a second confidence vote before the summer recess begins on 21st of July, a feat previously seen as administratively impossible. In his resignation letter, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak said the public expected government to be conducted properly, competently and seriously. The Health Secretary Sajid Javid wrote in his resignation letter, "We may not have always been popular, but we have been competent in acting in the national interest. Sadly, in the current circumstances, the public are concluding that we are now neither." He added, "The recent vote of confidence showed that a large number of our colleagues agree. It was a moment for humility, grip, and new direction. However, I regret to say that it is clear to me that this situation will not change under your leadership, and you have therefore lost my confidence too." Rishi Sunak highlighted differences of opinion over economic management between him and Boris Johnson in the run-up to a joint speech the pair had planned next days. It will increase speculation that he has not given up on a run at the premiership. Sunak and Javid resignations were followed by several more junior Tories quitting, including Alex Chalk as Solicitor General, who said he could no longer defend the culture and course set on Boris Johnson's watch. Jonathan Gullis, a former ultra-loyalist, stepped down as a parliamentary private secretary, while Bim Afolami quit as vice chair of the party. Jonathan Gullis said, "I feel for too long we have been more focused on dealing with our reputational damage rather than delivering for the people of this country and spreading opportunity for all. It is for this reason that I can no longer serve as part of your government." Former Brexit Minister Lord Frost urged Boris Johnson to resign, warning in the Telegraph, "If he hangs on, he risks taking the party and the government down with him." He said other cabinet ministers now needed to consider whether they are truly happy with the current direction of travel. Lord Frost wrote of the Chris Pincher scandal, "Confronted with a problem which appeared to reflect badly on the Prime Minister's judgment, we saw once again the instinct was to cover up, to conceal, to avoid confronting the reality of the situation." Theo Clark, former trade envoy to Kenya and member of the Women and Equality Select Committee, said, "To learn that Johnson chose to elevate a colleague to a position of pastoral care for MPs, whilst in full knowledge of his own wrongdoing, shows a severe lack of judgment and care for your parliamentary party." Andrew Morrison, a former trade envoy to Morocco, strongly urged Boris Johnson to go, saying, "He cannot square Johnson's patronage with my personal sense of decency and honour." Sagar Bharti, former parliamentary private secretary to the health secretary, said, "My conscience will not allow me to continue to support this administration." Tuesday's walkouts followed an extraordinary intervention over the Chris Pincher scandal. On Tuesday morning, former Foreign Office Permanent Secretary Simon MacDonald made clear in an excoriating letter that Johnson had been briefed about an investigation into Chris Pincher, a former Deputy Chief Whip in 2019. That contradicted statements from Downing Street that Boris Johnson did not know about specific claims against Pincher before he quit last week amid charges of inappropriate affairs. During a febrile day in Westminster, MPs in the House of Commons were told Boris Johnson did not immediately recall that he had been informed about an investigation into Chris Pincher. The Prime Minister later conceded it had been a mistake to appoint Pincher as Deputy Chief Whip, a role that involves pastoral care of MPs. Boris Johnson said, "What I wanted was to give Chris Pincher, if not the benefit of the doubt, then the ability to prove that he could do better. And I'm afraid that he couldn't. And I feel very, very bitterly disappointed and also sorry for the mistake that I made." Throughout the day, a growing number of Conservative MPs, including some who had previously been supportive, said this latest incident had been the last straw. Andrew Morrison, a former Conservative minister, resigned as a trade envoy, saying, "Others must square, as best they can, their continuing enjoyment of your patronage with their personal sense of decency, honour and integrity, but I no longer can." In February, reflecting on your achievements, I wrote a supportive opinion editorial for The Guardian, in which I said that if you were obliged to leave office, you would do so with your head held high. I would no longer write in those terms. Rishi Sunak published his resignation letter just minutes after Sajid Javid, saying, "I'm sad to be leaving government, but I have reluctantly come to the conclusion we cannot continue like this." He added, "The public rightly expected government to be conducted properly, competently and seriously. I recognise this may be my last ministerial job, but I believe these standards are worth fighting for, and that is why I'm resigning." Bim Afolami said, "I think what's been very sad over the recent charges about the former Deputy Chief Whip and other things that have happened over the last few weeks is that I just don't think the Prime Minister has any longer not just my support, but I don't think the support of the party, or indeed the country, anymore. I think for that reason he should step down." Boris Johnson had earlier toured the House of Commons tea room hoping to shore up support among his backbenchers. But one MP said his message about the Pincher scandal had been "everyone deserves a second chance," a sentiment that did not go down well with some present. As well as his new roles for Zahawi and Barclay, Boris Johnson appointed the Universities Minister Michelle Donnellan as Education Secretary to replace Zahawi. Sources close to other cabinet ministers, including Liz Truss, Ben Wallace, Dominic Raab and Priti Patel, said they would remain in post, but rumours of more junior resignations continued to sweep through Westminster. The leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, said if the ministers had a shred of integrity, they would have gone months ago. The British public will not be fooled. The Tory party is corrupted, and changing one man won't fix that. Only a real change of government can give Britain a fresh start that it needs.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says the Federation will be a partner in the lawsuit filed against the Israeli occupation in the International Criminal Court. A member of the executive board of the Federation says the move came after the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate succeeded in persuading the Federation to file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. IFJ stated that the filing comes in light of the Israeli aggression against Palestinian journalists and people. Earlier, the Journalist Syndicate had said that it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The circumstances of Shirin Abu Akleh's killing on May the 11th have been investigated by several international organizations. All concluded that it was a bullet fired from an Israeli rifle that killed the Al Jazeera correspondent and injured her fellow journalist as they covered an Israeli raid in Jenin. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. But the question is, will there and can there be accountability for the crimes committed by Israel?
And the absence of punishment shows hypocrisy, double standards, and deception and lies. So this is an opportunity for journalists to present all of the best documented evidence, research, discovery that they've done about crimes against humanity that the Israeli apartheid regime has committed. And the more international they go, the louder they go, the more they invite other countries to be participants, to join the lawsuit against Israel, the more you're building international consensus in support of the people who have been violated, dehumanized, killed, robbed, or in other way injured by this grotesque apartheid Israeli policy and agenda of genocide, bigotry, and destruction. So it's a very essential step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
Earlier this month, Palestinian officials handed over to U.S. forensic experts the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. But despite all the evidence pointing fingers towards Israel, the U.S. said it could not reach a definitive conclusion on the origin of the bullet. Meanwhile, Abu Akleh's family have expressed their anger over the U.S.'s disregard for what several courts and rights organizations have stated and its failure to accept that its ally has murdered a journalist in broad daylight. The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says that Israel was guilty of the crime and expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into Palestinian journalist Abu Akleh's killing. The U.S., on the other hand, has not condemned this act, yet aside from saying there needs to be an independent investigation, raising questions about whether the U.S. is seeking the truth or to protect its ally.
Well, absolutely, the U.S. is guilty of supporting the regime. The U.S. is guilty from enabling the regime to engage in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. has been guilty of stealing money from the American people and giving it to the Israeli apartheid regime and giving them weapons and, in fact, looking the other way when Israel had developed nuclear weapons. But that's another story. But Israel's crimes and abuses against the Palestinians, against the Syrians, against Lebanon, against all sorts of countries and nations and peoples, the U.S. is the partner in crime that is responsible. And if the U.S. does not hold a moral standard and a very clear objectivity and a dedication to truth and justice, then the U.S. is showing that it has no dedication to truth and justice, but instead has a dedication to lies and crime.
The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measures, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel. Yet no one, including the United Nations Security Council, has used any of its tools to ensure its resolutions. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has ruled that it has a mandate to investigate the occupied territories and has accepted the Palestinians after they were granted non-member observer status at the UN. This comes despite Palestinians' inability to join the ICC, as Israel is not a member and Palestinians do not qualify as a sovereign state. A new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which requires the full or partial disclosure of previously unreleased information and documents controlled by the U.S. government upon request, offers the first official confirmation of Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple countries. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allows U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. And now, the report indicated that American troops conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world between 2017 and 2020. The document also shows that at least 14 127E programs were also active in West Asia and the Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in West Asia, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E so-called counter-terrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen.
The actual main purpose of U.S. Special Forces is to train and educate foreign fighters. And so they've done this in places that we would never, that United States people would never support in Africa, Central America, and places like that. And in fact, we created the School of the Americas, which trained Central American people to how to torture people properly.
The 127E program, an obscure program that even U.S. lawmakers are not familiar with, one that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by, with, and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. But all this only seems to be another term for waging a proxy war in another country through the use of local forces. origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support militants there. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known as Section 1208, the authority was deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion, according to a former senior defense official. It was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, Section 127E. But so far, the U.S. waging of proxy wars and its use of local forces to achieve its aims have been costly for countries targeted by Washington.
I guess I would use the example of the Philippines, where Duterte, who was a very right-leaning president, kicked the United States Special Forces out, even though they were operating in his space in support of what he was doing. He kicked them out because he just didn't want that element in his country. American foreign policy is insane in every way that it possibly can be.
Critics in the U.S. have also contended that, due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders, on the other hand, claim it is crucial to combating terrorism. But so far, the U.S.'s proxy wars in most countries where this program has been implemented, including West Asian nations like Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, have mostly been witnessing instability, which is more likely than not a direct result of the program and proxy elements and fighters. Racist policies are enshrined in Israeli law, however, one specifically denies 6 million Palestinians the right to return to the territory from which they were expelled only a few decades ago. The same law, however, permits Jews across the world to settle in any part of Palestine. Such practices, including the racial fragmentation of Palestine into zones of control, where half of the population enjoys full rights of citizenship denied to the non-Jewish half, have led most human rights groups and advocates to label Israel as an apartheid state. Meanwhile, Israel continuously and explicitly rejects international consensus and seems to have found strong support for their radical position from the Texas Republican Party in foreclosing any chance of a Palestinian state from ever being established.
Violence and instability are perhaps a good thing because violence implies that there will be resistance to this land grab and this denial of Palestinian rights. And as far as I'm concerned, the more resistance, the better. And Palestine needs to do resistance, and it needs its friends and allies to participate in resistance. I know that the policy of Iran and Syria and some other nations is to support Palestine in this kind of resistance. And in fact, it is now going in the direction that the entire world is saying, well, we're not going to listen to the United States anymore and NATO, for example, because the United States has now declared sanctions against so many countries that those countries are unifying amongst themselves to defy the United States. So we may be entering a new period when, unfortunately, violence, but resistance and most likely violent resistance is the only answer to the warmongers.
Though party platforms do not necessarily translate into government policy, critics cite the former U.S. President Donald Trump and the support enjoyed by Israel amongst powerful religious figures, as well as fringe elements in the U.S. society, to argue that the most extreme and rejectionist views about the apartheid have become normalized in U.S. politics. In further signs that support for Israel has morphed into an extremist position in the U.S., the Texas Republican Party has approved a platform that will make it illegal to create a Palestinian state in territories controlled by Israel. The platform, approved by 5,100 delegations in Houston, supports the prohibition of a Palestinian state within the so-called historical borders of Israel, as they claim it would jeopardize Israel's security. This platform, in essence, only lays the groundwork for further Israeli aggression and discrimination against Palestinians. Currently, as many as 12 million people reside in historic Palestine, but full rights are granted by the regime to Jews only, leaving the remaining 6 million non-Jews prone to various forms of racial discrimination depending on their place of residence. But does this type of platform represent the thinking of the U.S. as a whole when it comes to Palestinians, that they shouldn't have a right to their own land?
The United States has a long tradition of denying people their land rights and their homeland. We've done it to 500 nations in North America. So this is not at all surprising that they would say that the Palestinians should be denied their homeland. At the same time, the Zionists are immensely powerful and have powerful friends in the United States. So, particularly in the power structure and the political structure.
All this poses some serious question about the future of Palestinians in light of the U.S. and Israeli plots amid what seems to be international silence over the matter.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital, Madrid, to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliaments and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit. And this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the U.S. is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Ilm-e Fiqh az ulum-e sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. Stay tuned.
Assalamu
انسانی مجالست کنید من یذکر و کمالله وقتی باش می نشینی بالاخره یاد خدا و پیغمبر و
We as Muslims must accompany those people whose presence remind us about Allah, the Holy Quran, religion and ethics. However, in today's world, our friends are usually concerned with materialistic world. Now, these mundane inclinations will affect our souls and will keep us away from religious values. Accompanying the men of God will improve your spirituality in life.
این تهران خدا رحمت کند مرحوم آیت الله العظما است احمد خونساری رضوان الله علیه
The late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari was one of the greatest ulama in the city of Tehran. When he passed away, he was buried in a grave beside the grave of the late Allama Tabatabai in vicinity of the tomb of Lady Fatimatul Masuma in the holy city of Qom. The late Imam Khomeini sent a message of condolence on the day this great man passed away. The late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari was an epitome of religious morality and virtuous lifestyle. Whenever I and other young students went to his sessions, we were affected by the high quality of his spiritual life. Even 1 minute of accompanying this great man could change your whole way of life. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Hosseini Qomi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iran's embassy in Lebanon held a ceremony to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the abduction of four Iranian nationals in Lebanon. Iranian ambassador to Lebanon lauded the four men as messengers of peace to Lebanon, noting that Israel was behind their abduction.
We are pursuing the case of our four diplomats via diplomatic and legal means, as their fate is very important for us. This ceremony is being held to honor and remember our diplomats, and it helps us shed light on the fate of our kidnapped diplomats. We have repeatedly said that we have documents and evidence showing our diplomats were handed over to the Israeli regime following their abduction. Israel is politically and legally held accountable for their abduction. We will pursue their case until their fate is known.
A military attaché at Tehran's embassy in Beirut, Ahmad Mutavassilian, along with Iranian charge d'affaires in Lebanon, Mohsen Mousavi, an employee of the embassy Taqir Asdiqar Muqaddam, and a photographer for the Islamic Republic Agency, Qasim Akhavan, were abducted on July 4, 1982. Lebanese militiamen from the Lebanese Forces Group admitted to kidnapping the four men who were on a diplomatic mission in North Lebanon. Investigations show that they were last handed over to Israel at the time.
The legal follow-up of this case in the last few years proves without a doubt that these men were kidnapped on a militia checkpoint, and it was proven that they were put in the jails of that well-known militia which was collaborating with the occupation entity. There are testimonies that they were handled over to the occupation forces. The Lebanese government has a responsibility to follow up the case to highest levels, including the International Criminal Court.
Those in attendance called for an objective investigation by the United Nations and the International Red Cross. Although there is information about those who abducted the Iranian diplomats and their whereabouts, the fate of these Iranians remains shrouded in mystery. The families and Iranian officials believe they remain detained in Israeli jails. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
British Indians flocked to central London Sunday to condemn India's ruling government over its failures to protect Indian minorities from persecution. The anger comes after a string of incidents saw huge numbers of India's 204 million Muslims turn against the authorities, which Muslims claim are systematically discriminating against them.
Violence and discriminatory rhetoric against minorities in India has become so commonplace that many onlookers fear that a genocide may be on the horizon. Muslims in particular are fearful, given that Islamophobic hate crimes have run rampant in India.
Accusations against New Delhi include allowing sectarian attacks on mosques, failing to stop anti-Muslim lynch mobs, hijab bans, and the bulldozing of homes in Muslim areas, essentially a type of ethnic cleansing.
What's happened to minorities in India, if you don't know, is it is on the brink of genocide. This peaceful demonstration is not against India. I want to repeat, it's not against India, it's against the government of India. They are not doing anything, they are complacent. They are basically wanting to make India into a Hindu Rashtra and move away from democracy.
I think that it's wrong that there should be hijab bans. It's wrong that people should be persecuted for interfaith relationships. It's wrong that Indian Muslim homes are bulldozed. And it's wrong, as we saw with Indian farmers, that there's state sanction, sedition and suppression of rights and views and peaceful protests.
India's Prime Minister, who heads the ruling BJP party, has been accused of pushing an extremist Hindu nationalism, which preaches intolerance of other religious groups. Under Narendra Modi's watch, India has been routinely condemned by human rights groups over anti-Muslim discrimination, but the attention of Western leaders has been more focused on building trade with India to help combat economic instability. And that is why, so far, concerns by Muslims in India have fallen mostly on deaf ears. Robert Carter, London.
Donetsk is on fire. The Ukrainian army has been bombing civilian areas of this city for three straight days. We travelled to one of the areas hit yesterday and this morning. Markets are common targets for the Ukrainians, presumably because they are more likely to kill, and in the hope of breaking the will of the Donbass people who support Russia.
How can they kill civilians? It's awful. What are they doing? What purpose are they doing it for? We didn't do anything to them. We need peace. We need to work, to raise our children. Terrible things are going on. We have to sit in basements without food or water. We need peace.
Now, our driver has just told us to hurry up. Indeed, one of the women we interviewed also told us afterwards to get out of here quickly, as there could be more incoming. Now, while it's quiet at the moment in Donetsk, frankly, you can be hit anywhere at any time. The hotel behind the market is still on fire. It was hit this morning. Locals tell me the same place is often bombed hours later in the hope of killing those who come to inspect the damage. A piece of deadly shrapnel lies on the road. Now, I've just entered a residential area just adjacent to the market. We've heard that there were a couple of people killed here earlier. A shell pounding the apartments with shrapnel. A woman and her children appear at the window,
She tells me it hit a couple of hours ago. Shrapnel smashed through her window.
No, we've just seen people running for shelter. We've just sheltered down ourselves. As they've been incoming here, we heard the explosion a little bit. We're way off. But this area is still very dangerous. We strikes any time. Now, we were going to try and find the woman. The two people killed are relatives of them, but frankly, my team has said we've got to get out of here, as it's just too dangerous.
At the market, the anger amongst people is palpable. The women I speak to are visibly angry at me for being British.
You're scoundrels, those who kill civilians, children. More than 200 people have been killed in Donetsk these previous months, not to mention those wounded. So many children have died. It's outrageous. There's no forgiveness for this. They're killers. They're murdering ordinary people for the sake of their own interest. Why don't you look after your own country? All the best to you. What shall I tell my child? That I have no money and we have nothing to eat? That everything was sheltered here? What have you come here for? Do you give me any money? I have to provide for my child and live somehow. And where do I earn money now? I've been working here for 20 years. 20 years. And it's all over now.
Scenes like this are played out across the city every day now, as Western governments and media focus on alleged Russian war crimes. In Donetsk, Ukraine is getting away with murder. The guns and ammunition for these attacks are increasingly being paid by taxpayers in NATO countries. Three were killed yesterday, five the day before, and already today, a 10-year-old girl has been killed. Under the almost constant crash of new explosions, civilians are being slaughtered every day. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Tehran has organized the fourth edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Qari Babadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
The Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.